Every week for the past quite a few years, we have done a regular political chat on the show, Week in Politics, we call it. And while quite a few voices from across the political spectrum have cycled through, our stalwarts, the original duo, are David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Georgetown's McCourt School. Well, with politics in limbo, along with just about everything else right now, I was curious how they are keeping busy, what is bringing them comfort right now. So, David, E.J., Jay, welcome back. We'll call it Week in Comfort.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
So good to hear your voices. David, I'm going to call on you first because I noticed you've been writing about mental health in the age of the coronavirus. What's the central tension as you see it?
Well, I asked my readers, my New York Times readers, to send me little letters on how they're holding up. And I think I sort of expected a lot of cheerful coming together stories. But what I got shocked me. It was heartrending and gutting, frankly. I've gone through about 5,000 of the letters now.
5,000, wow.
Yeah, and people are just open and vulnerable. A lot of people are crying a lot. There are young women. It tends to be the young who feel hopeless, who feel their plans for the futures have suffered this devastating setback, a loss of purpose, a loss of hope. Then the old, especially widows and widowers, talk about the precariousness of it, the loneliness of it. They just feel vulnerable, extremely vulnerable. And then those with existing mental health conditions, one of them wrote to me, I used to be able to escape my unhappiness, but now my unhappiness is chained to me. So while a lot of people are doing pretty well, there is just this river of woe out there that really has shocked me and humbled me, and we should be aware that it's around all of us.
Mm, yeah, it's hard even to hear you quoting all of those, that river of woe, as you call it. I will say I underlined one line in your column that doesn't speak to quite that level of misery, but I wrote yes in big letters next to it, and it was you writing that you're mentally exhausted by 5 p.m. every day, and that part of that is the unconscious stress that is flowing through all of us. I mean, this is real, no matter where we are right now.
Yeah, and it's an invisible stress, sort of pervasive. I don't have moments of panic or stress, but somehow it's just underlining everything and everybody. I cope with it. Obviously, it's a time to be an aggressive friend. Also, it's a moment to be with nature as much as possible, but also to see that there's meaning in it. The moments of suffering can be moments of great meaning when people's lives feel defined. I'm in love with this quote by Paul Tillich, a 1950s theologian, who says that moments of suffering interrupt your life and they remind you you're not the person you thought you were. They carve through the floor of the basement of your soul and reveal much deeper depths than you ever knew you had before.
Oh, that's beautiful. EJ, you've written in the past about the quality of resilience and about the importance of confronting doubt with faith and sadness with joy. How are you thinking about that with this crisis?
Well, you know, David's quoting Paul Tillich reminded me of Martin Luther King's famous line that unearned suffering is redemptive. And I would underscore what David said by of all those folks who are in trouble because of a lack of social connection right now, a sense of isolation, with a critique of the term social distancing, because I like those who want to replace it with physical distancing, because we need more social connection right now. I know that what keeps me going most are connections with family and friends, including members of my family who are always trying to protect me from doing something stupid. And my Georgetown students I see every day on Zoom. But the most resilient person I think I've ever met is my mother-in-law, whom I wrote about many years ago, a couple of years ago when she died. She was one of those people who always says, God never sends you something you can't handle. But that was because of her attitude toward life. She lost her husband. She was 38, left with little money. It was a blue collar family and six kids aged 2 to 16. And the way she kept going was by not only by not feeling sorry for herself. She didn't focus on how unlucky she was. She thought of herself still as lucky with those six kids. She focused on those hurting even more than she was. She was hurting, and she reached out to help them. There were some extraordinary stories in her life. And I think there are so many people out there right now who are doing precisely that, to whom we should feel very grateful.
David, what's keeping you going, by the way? We heard EJ there mention his students, his family keeping him on the straight and narrow. What are you leaning on?
Yeah, I think, as I said, nature, I take the same run every day now, and just watching the buds emerge on the trees, just a little, it gives you that 3,000 year mind, yeah, that this is a long story. And frankly, reading the book of Isaiah, there are small peoples, Jews are about to celebrate Passover. There are small peoples who've been swept out of their homes, who've been swept out. But what the Bible teaches us, whether you believe in God or not, is that these are redemptive moments, as EJ said, and these are moments that, through the long scope of history, that do come to define us.
Yeah, we just have a short moment left, but I wonder if you two want to say anything straight to each other, as friends and colleagues who've spent a lot of time over the years on this show debating the state of our country and our world. EJ.
Well, I want to say back in the day when David and I actually disagreed about politics even more than we do now, one of the things that brought us together was a love of community and a belief that what people did for each other was much more important than some notion of radical individualism and individual accomplishment. And I want to salute David for pointing out the times of crisis like this are times when human beings get really inventive about new forms of social organization, and he's encouraging that, and I appreciate that.
And David, a parting shot from you to EJ.
Yeah, we've been doing this 25 years. I just calculated. Our ideological differences have never led to anything but emotional closeness. And I think EJ and I are doppelgangers, and I do think I know I love you, and I think you love me. And it helps that EJ's default setting is extreme cheerfulness. And that has kept us together.
That's lovely.
Thank you, David.
Do you want to respond to that, EJ? I'll give you another few seconds to respond.
Normally I have a pithy, quick comeback to David on that, and I have no pithy comeback at all except thank you.
Well, I will offer a parting shot, which is, as we talk about friendship and what to call it, social distancing, physical distancing, it's remarkable to hear you. You're usually here in the studio with me. We're usually all together. We can see each other face to face, and we're all trying to figure out how we do this via Zoom or FaceTime or Skype, and it's lovely to hear two old friends say I love you on the phone line. So thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Great to be with you, with Mary Louise.
That is David Brooks of the New York Times and EJ Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution.